Happy New Year, everyone!
Happy New Year!
2014.
Oh my goodness.
Jonathan James Kramer. And what's your name?
David Matthew Berkman with a cold.
Oh my god. Everyone's got colds.
It's gross.
Don't cough on the internet.
Oh. Wait, is that against the law?
Don't get the internet sick. Stick it up as it is.
Oh, it'll be fine.
Alright,
Well, welcome. It is what is it? What are we? Tuesday, January the 7th, 2014. Did we say that already?
No, I don't think we said that.
Who are you?
hello, welcome, everyone. The first show of the new year, 2014. Steven, do you have any predictions, rants?
I predict that it's going to be a fantastic year, and we're going to have the coldest temperatures ever in North America.
Maybe like worse than the ice age?
Well, we broke like something like 100 records in our state, the state of New York today. One being 5 degrees at not even 7 o'clock this morning in Central Park. It broke 118-year-old record for the lowest temperature ever recorded. So what's next?
Well, I don't know, but do you have any predictions for this year?
Predictions. Yeah. I predict I'm going to lose 10 pounds.
Okay.
And then I'm going to find it.
Political predictions.
Any political predictions?
I think Obama's going to do something with this unemployment benefit thing. I know it made its way through the House or through the first round or whatever today. And it's probably good for the economy. We'll see.
Kind of a lot.
I feel like we're going to get a lot of buzz about the 2016 run.
I don't know. Ends. I think Obama lost a lot of fans from the NSA. For me, he was going downhill, and then, I mean, I'm not a fan of politics anyway. I don't follow it. After the NSA thing, I was like, great. You had a great job to be an amazing political leader after Bush, because you can't get as bad as Bush right now.
And then
apparently you can. No,
So maybe Stone will come back and teach us a couple of things.
Yeah.
Or make whatever.
Who knows?
I don't want to get into politics.
But we were
Or religion.
But somehow we'll probably touch. So we have an excellent guest with us tonight named Mark Dale. He's got a very interesting background, and I guess I can give you a little bit of what we know about him. He is a novelist. He's just released his second book, and he's worked as a corporate litigator in Chicago. He's traveled all around the world. So let's give him a call right now. Let's add him to the conversation, and let's see what he has to say. Like I said, he's been all over. He's got his second book coming on. I believe actually it might already be out. And I think if I read correctly, he fled South Korea as a fugitive. Hello, Mark. Are you there?
I am. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello. Welcome to the show. And if you could get a little closer to the mic if you can, just so we can get maximum volume.
You bet. I usually am a little loud, so.
All right, perfect.
We like loud.
So we are broadcasting from the New York City area. We're actually in Hoboken, New Jersey. Steven lives in Hell's Kitchen in Manhattan. We used to broadcast from there, but it was easier for everyone to come to Hoboken. So anyway, welcome to the show, and welcome to everyone listening from all around the world, from the interwebs. So, Mark, there's so many things I want to ask you. You've got this new book that just came out, but I'm kind of interested to hear a little bit about South Korea. You were there, and did you make it to North Korea, or were you just in South Korea? You were in Hong Kong. What was that trip about?
Yeah, I met my wife in South Korea. We worked together at a place that made English textbooks and taught English as a second language, and she taught little kids. And I taught college prep English. We dated secretly for a year before her parents had her followed one day because they didn't believe her story and chased us out of the country with the police.
Why? Because she was dating an American or what?
Yeah, I mean, in that culture, and especially this was 20 years ago, the whole family's reputation was all tied together. So if she dates me, it brings down the whole family, and then it makes it harder for her sister, who had just gotten married by an arranged marriage in her new life, or it would make it harder for her younger brother to eventually get an arranged marriage for himself. It besmirched the entire reputation of the family.
I didn't realize it was that serious. I know we see that in some Indian and Arab cultures, and I know Asian cultures, I didn't think it was as prevalent. I didn't think it was as serious in South Korea, which is fairly, a modern country. It's not a third world country by any means.
Right. But what it is I think even here that might be more of the case in certain families, sort of the upper crust, ruling class type families.
Right.
And the more recently the country developed, the more disparity there is between the few in the ruling class and the majority who are not. So it really was more based on the position of her family in South Korea than South Korea itself.
Okay, I see. So definitely. So they wanted her to marry a prominent South Korean gentleman, and it sounds almost like aristocracy.
Yeah, that's exactly. Her sister went to the best school in the country, came to the United States to get a master's degree, returned with her master's and said, "Okay, Mom and Dad, I'm ready to get married. Find me a husband." And they went to a matchmaker who found this guy for her with 6 factories in South Korea. And her family was a little bigger name. They had the prestige, and his family had a little more money, and they put them together. And that sister is actually the one who followed us and caught us dating. So.
Oh, geez. That's the complete opposite of my experience. I married an Italian woman. And mom's like, "Hurry up, get married, have babies." Forcing her to marry me. So what? So you, that was about 20 years ago, you said.
Yep.
And then you went to law school when you guys came to the States, or?
Yeah. And I'm actually writing this as a book now. We're going to release it at the end of October, which will be our 20th wedding anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
I just had my 1 year. And Stephen, you had your...
October's a lovely month.
So after that, you studied law. You practiced law in Chicago.
Yeah. After we got chased out of Korea, we ran to Hong Kong. We were stranded in Hong Kong. Almost starved to death in Hong Kong.
Oh, my goodness. What did you do for work?
Nothing in Hong Kong, which was why, we weren't legal to work there, and they don't need English teachers in Hong Kong because it was a British colony at the time. So we were basically stranded there. We couldn't come here because she didn't have a visa to enter the United States.
Okay.
And we thought getting married would fix that, but it doesn't because she wasn't a resident of Hong Kong. So we nearly starved to death in Hong Kong.
Jesus Christ. Now, so that was over 20 years ago?
That was not quite 20 years ago, because we were there for a few months. So.
Oh, gotcha. But still, it was pre-9/11, so it was lax immigration-wise. It was much easier to get to the States back then compared to now.
That might be true. I don't know. You'll have to read the book when it comes out, of course. We had to go through a lot to get here. And then when we came back, we applied to graduate schools in my hometown, which is Iowa City, Iowa. And it was basically like, if we're in grad school, we can get student loans and live in student housing and not die.
Right, live on the government dollar for a while.
Right, exactly. Or at least borrow dollars.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Then they find us 20 years later, like, "Remember that bill?" Anyway, go on.
So I ended up in law school and then worked I started out in a little firm doing many cases and small cases and trying about a case a week. And arbitrating and all of it. I was just in court constantly, and I sort of worked my way up to the big leagues, and I worked for this giant corporate law firm, kind of a John Grisham kind of thing.
Mark, what did you get your law degree in? Do you have a focus?
They call it a Juris Doctorate.
Yeah.
So it's pretty much, the specialty comes afterwards, and they basically said, "Oh yeah, this guy can talk. Put him in front of a courtroom."
That's actually similar to what happened to my dad. My dad was a litigator as well, and they're like, "All right, this kid's young, he's hungry. Throw him in the courtroom."
Yeah. Yep, and you're just basically, it's gladiators.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that was going to be my first career choice.
Gladiator?
No, not Gladiator.
That's the problem about you, Stephen.
I'm very interested in my final years of my undergraduate, which is in journalism, in like entertainment law. So I wanted to go get like a JD MBA kind of thing.
Okay.
And be there and be like, you know, Jay-Z's attorney.
I thought you
don't know where the transition
you
was.
You saw the movie Gladiator. You
yeah, and I wanted to wear a dress.
Well, that exchange.
No,
that's true.
I was in the MBA program as well. Actually, I got into the joint program, and they had an orientation on the first day, and they had us working in groups. And the first time we had to build a tower out of note cards. And they wouldn't let us talk to each other. We could only gesture. And then the second time, we got to build the tower talking to each other, and we learned the importance of group communication. And then we had a break for lunch, and I left, and I never came back.
Yeah, I was accepted on the national grants to go back to school in 1998, and I was having a life event at that moment. And I decided not to go back to school and to open up a catering business in Montauk, which was
I didn't know you had a catering business.
Oh, yeah.
Was that where you started Ghost?
Well, no, and we closed in 2002, but we were very successful for 4 years. And I don't regret that at all.
Cool.
Yeah. Right, so you went, you were working for a big firm. Like you said, sort of John Grisham style. Is that the one where the structure is there's a couple partners making tons of money off basically slaves?
It was actually more like there were 15 levels of partners, and everybody was a slave, but some got a lot of money for it.
Right, the few guys at the top, sort of like a pyramid.
Right, you know, and I was way down at the bottom, and, you know, the pay was fantastic, but, you know, when I went to law school, I thought it was like you come up with the brilliant new argument, and you say that argument, and then that's how you win. You win by figuring it out. And going through law school and trying all these cases and getting into the big firm, I realized that's not really the case. How you win is, number one, you have the biggest law firm with the greatest number of librarians and paralegals and secretaries and all these people that can do work for you, you know, a support staff. And the other thing is that when you do all that research, you don't find the new argument because that's untested. What you do is you find the argument that won last time with a case sort of like yours.
So a precedent. But also isn't a lot of it too. I remember my dad telling, you know, a story about him and another lawyer going up against some of these huge firms, and they just sort of bury you in paperwork and, you know, file this motion and that motion. And so it's tough to go up against a big company like a class action suit unless you've got a giant team behind you, because they'll just bury you.
Precisely. And that was where I really started to figure out that, you know, when I was in Asia, I saw that the countries there had these very strict hierarchies throughout the whole society. You know, if you think Japan and Korea and, you know, the Chinese culture, they're all very hierarchical societies. And what occurred to me living there was they had few resources and a whole lot of people crammed into a little space. And then I came back and I started studying in law school about, you know, how people regulate each other. And by the time I got to the big firm, I could see that we're doing the same thing here. And as the world's running out of resources, we're becoming a more structured society. We have to find ways to keep everybody controlled more. And then I got into this giant firm where every minute of every day I had to account, what was it, 6/10 of a minute? Of an hour.
It's billable time.
And that's your whole day.
It's billable time. I'm giving testimony in a hearing tomorrow for a lawsuit against my company to the tune of $357,000 for a letter that a parent says that they didn't receive, and I have a response from the letter that I sent to her that she said she didn't receive. And she forgot that she sent that, so tomorrow's going to be a fun day for her.
Uh-oh. Well, no, it's funny you're mentioning that sort of structure in the States. It's really hidden. You know, we don't realize it. And the example I saw in North America was I lived for a long time in Quebec. I just moved here for my wife about 2 years ago from Montreal. And I can't, you would not believe how structured and regulated Canada is. I mean, you cannot even go to the bathroom and have a bowel movement without getting some sort of permit. And you'll probably get fined because you didn't fill out the permit properly. It just, everything costs so much. I really found, toward the end, Quebec very frightening. I found that there were just so many laws and rules and regulations, and it almost felt like it was impossible to stay legal. You're gonna do something wrong. You're gonna step out of line. It's North America's best kept secret, and the States is getting like that too. I mean, we're becoming so structured and so policed. It's frightening, and I'm just learning about it. That's one of the reasons why, you know, I wanted to get a show on the station and have, you know, guests like you who can elucidate us and, you know, tell us a lot about what you've learned and what you're discovering.
When I was in Singapore, you know, Singapore's famous for its laws like that. Selling chewing gum, I think, is $1,000 fine, or it was at that time. The fines just went up. And, I mean, some of them, like not flushing a public toilet. You know, if you have need of a public toilet, you sure want somebody to have flushed it. But I think the fine for not flushing it, forgetting to flush, was $500. And, that's the place where the kid was spray painting cars and they gave him, they beat him with a stick and left permanent scars on him.
Oh, jeez.
So.
Well, don't they have the death penalty for a lot of, like, even minor drug offenses, right?
Right. 15 grams, I think, is the law in Singapore. 15 grams or they hang you.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I had a friend of mine who was he was in Singapore. I didn't hear much about it. He's just back to the States after years and years, but he had a lot of stories. He was in Japan for 10 years, and he said it was so structured that you'd go to a store or the equivalent of the DMV, and there'd be arrows pointing exactly where you had to go, point A, point B, and then arrows, and people would just follow the arrows. No one would question it.
Right, and I moved from Iowa, where there were fewer people and, you know, fewer regulations like that, to Chicago. And, you know, all of a sudden I need a sticker to have on my car. And, you know, I said, well, what's the sticker for? You know, I got a license plate, I got, you know, the registration sticker. Oh, no, this is a city sticker. Well, what's it do? Well, you pay us $90 and you get a sticker. And if you don't have it, then you're going to have to pay a fine. Oh, so it's a tax. Oh, no, it's not a tax. It's a sticker. And everybody here has to have a sticker. And they just had all of these weird little things like that that add up over time. And pretty soon, you know, you can't turn around.
Oh, yes, it's insane. And I'm just, like I said, coming back, I was out of the States for almost 20 years, so I'm just learning about this stuff now. And I just can't believe it, you know, that it's becoming like that. It's getting worse. And without mentioning politicians, like we said before, I mean, even some of the more, you know, left-leaning people that I know are even starting to go, wait a minute, this transcends left or right, Republican, Democrat. This is a serious problem in humanity right now.
Right, and I think that really is the key, not just in my book, but in what's happening right now, is the left and right dichotomy is being manipulated so we stay at each other's throats. And it's really more of a dichotomy between those who are starting to see that what we're being told and what we're seeing every day isn't quite real, and those who just don't care to see that. And everybody on the side of the people who are awake are trying to figure it out and trying to say, well, okay, I know that, you know, the cartoon animal in the ad is lying to me. This is not a healthy snack, for example.
Yeah.
But I don't know how deep it goes, and I don't know what to do. And meanwhile, you know, it's the left and right leg marching us into this world of my book, 17.
Now, the book is a novel, and what's the premise? Is, you know, the 17 billion people, and it's about survival. What exactly is sort of a... Just give us an overview of the novel.
Yeah, let's get started with the book idea. Yeah.
Well, but it's all one big picture. I think everything we've been talking about is kind of, you know, is related.
I mean, I don't know if you followed us for any period of time too, but Jonathan, I almost called you Michael. Jonathan just did National
Novel Writing Month. Yeah, we read a novel in a month in November, so I did that. So
I did see that. Yeah.
Yeah, so I've done that. But anyway, it's probably not as structured as yours because we just sort of churned it out in a month, even though I had the idea for a while. But Yours seems to be, obviously it takes place a bit in the future, because it's 17 book, 17 book ones, that's the title?
Yes, it's the first of a series, and it follows humanity as we evolve into a corporate species. And the idea is basically that all these regulations aren't just accidental. They keep us, they're guiding us into a corporate lifestyle. You know, the people who are the most able to survive, to reproduce, to live in a comfortable way are the people who are the most corporate. And the people who are farther out of those big institutions are the ones that are being basically weeded out. And so I extrapolate that in the future, and I say, okay, well, let's figure out what happens when, if you're not in a corporation, and the corporations have now taken over everything in the world, so that you don't have small business anymore. There's no secondary economy. If you're booted out of your corporation, you live in a war zone, basically. The entire world is a ghetto unless you're in a corporation. And if you're in that corporation, it's like I had in the big law firm, where every minute of every day is completely regulated, and you are either serving that employer or you're at risk of being thrown to the wolves. Except there are no wolves, because there are nothing but humans killing each other.
It's almost like you could transplant that metaphor to religion too, if you're in some aspects of society, if you're not, or it's more historical, yeah. If you're not, well, in your case,
thinking of the entity, whatever.
Then you could be ostracized and exiled, and some people have to play the game, and that seems to be, you know, what's starting to happen to,
or at least roll the dice.
But in your book, do you have a protagonist who is trying to, you know, almost like an Aldous Huxley, a Huxleyan character, I guess we could say, who's sort of suddenly wakes up and says, wait a minute, this is
right. I use some tropes like that. And one thing that I like to do in my writing is take a trope that people know. My first book was my response to the Twilight series, where the young girl fantasizes that her new boyfriend's a vampire because he's pale and skinny and stays up all night.
Okay.
And she discovers that he's a cocaine addict.
Okay.
And, you know, the book just kind of takes this angle, and it's like, well, you thought this was going to be, you fall in love with the vampire, and, you know. And then he turns out to be a cokehead, and she gets hooked on coke and becomes a dealer and sees herself as a vampire who's feeding on the next generation. So I like to play with the tropes. And in this one, I've got a homeless alcoholic who people call the prophet tells this waitress, Edie, that she is the general who's going to lead a revolution and change all of this system. And
wait, so the homeless alcoholic is a male?
Right,
okay.
The prophet.
Just checking. You never know.
Nothing is here.
Right.
Oh, no.
Never mind. Go on.
All right. So it basically follows her and her story as people sort of join with her, and there's this sort of resistance that builds up. But the story really takes a totally different turn than what it appears to be. So it looks like a Star Wars. It looks kind of like a Terminator with the waitress, you know, and it's got a lot of Orwellian kinds of things. There's a guy that writes things in a notebook, but all of it gets changed around. She gets a hold of the notebook. She starts using it as a guide for her life, and basically to as a Bible almost in her quest to overthrow this system. But, you know, the system is one of resources. It's not one of just arbitrary government, you know, a powerful government with nothing else. It's that corporations have taken control of the government. Corporations have taken control of all the resources. So when you're outside and you're leading this revolution, there's nothing to lead it with. It's just concrete. And once in a while, you might see a steel reinforcement rod poking up. But there's nothing left in the world. And it's against this backdrop that I show, you know, what is it that you're really doing when you say, I'm going to give up, you know, another year of my life and let the law firm pay for my taxi at 11:30 every night to get home? You know, that's what you're doing. You're saying, I'm choosing to be on the side with all these resources and no freedom whatsoever.
Well, that's, and it's like you're paying for, well, what you believe is comfort and what you believe is safety. And that's, you know, we have that today, the same thing that happened after 9/11 and the same thing that, you know, and, you know, even Hollywood portrayed it pretty well with that movie V for Vendetta, which is pretty good with the idea of, well, and like you said, you know, this sort of Orwellian concept of Big Brother and I can, even people, very intelligent, educated people I know still have the attitude of, well, I'm not doing wrong, doing anything wrong, so I don't mind if the government spies on me. I'm like, that's not the point. Like,
they're still spying
on you. The point is, like, you're giving up all your control. And you've, I wonder if this, you know, plays into your novel. You've, I'm sure, seen it a lot more than, you know, than we have. And I'm just amazing how accepting people just lay down. And it's easier that way. Because, like, what are you going to do? Like, you just feel like it's hope. Like, who am I going to take arms up against this giant entity that has unlimited resources and I have none?
Right. So, and I, yeah, do you have a comment? Because I have a question.
Well, I was going to say, that's where I, and the final piece of that puzzle for me was when I went from the little firm to the big firm, and I realized I'm the same guy, I'm the same lawyer, and there is no way I could have taken the new me, the guy in the big firm, on from that little firm. I would have been wiped out, just like every small business is now being wiped out.
Yeah, they would have just pushed you to the side and said,
right,
Mark, who?
Or had you regulated out of existence.
Or bared you, yeah.
Yeah. And so my question was, you mentioned 9/11, and I like to ask people that come onto our show, I'm fighting a cold, so if I sound a little nasal, my excuses. Do you remember where you were September 11th, 2001?
Yes.
And what were you doing? Where were you and what were you doing?
I had just started in the new law firm.
In the big one?
In the big one.
Okay.
And so I was in a big tower like that.
Yeah.
At the time. And it was really interesting because, you know, it's downtown Chicago. Everybody's in a high rise. You look out on the street, there's nobody there. And then this announcement comes, you know, half an hour maybe after the news broke. You know, well, okay, anybody who wants to can go home. And the secretaries went home. Some of the paralegals went home. Not a single lawyer left that tower.
Yeah, and were you glued to your computer at that point, too, like checking on news updates and stuff?
But, you know, it was, you're in this big office building when big office buildings are tumbling to the ground and killing everybody inside them. And you know that if you leave, that's it. You're not coming back. They're never going to forgive that.
Right.
You got work to do.
Right. Interesting. Wow. So it was like, do it, like, stay.
Where were you?
I was in Quebec City, and I remember it. I remember this girl I work with who had just come back from New York City and had been in the World Trade Center, and she said, she called me up and said, hey, check CNN, and the CNN website crashed.
Fine.
And then I saw it was just the first. So I remember I was at my desk in Quebec City working as a writer, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I had just woken up as the first plane hit, and I was literally making a cup of coffee for my friends who were visiting.
Were you in New York City?
I was living in East Hampton.
Okay.
And it was I remember it was a gorgeous day. It was like no humidity, blue skies, big puffy clouds.
Anyway,
out of towers.
Yeah, I know. And here comes Katie Kirk. Goes, oh, I think something's happening. And then the second plane hit, and I went. So I woke everybody up in the house, and they said, all right, it's time to have coffee and have a little discussion about what's going on. And we all just kind of shut the television off, turned off all of our cell phones, unplugged the computer, and just took a walk to the end of our block and sat in the Adirondack chairs in front of an American flag that was at half-mast and enjoyed our coffee for the morning and then went back and dealt with the world because we didn't know what else to do.
Yeah.
Well, you know, like, how do you respond to that? That's never happened in American history, really. No one's really attacked us like that ever at that level.
So Mark, in your novel, do you have, you know, sort of the comparison we've heard sometimes is the barbarians at the gates. That would be the, you know, the extremist Muslims and then the first world country like the United States. Do you have sort of themes like that in your novel where you know, these marginalized people, these this, I guess, rising force. They're sort of, they're seen as the barbarians at the gate, and they are gently, you know, quick, you know, slowly chipping away at the Roman Empire. Or how are they seen, like the protagonists, and then sort of that group that's rising up?
Yeah, well, you know, and I'm sure it's kind of like this with the Manhattan business district. You know, in Chicago we had the Loop, and there was a look to the people who were supposed to be there. You know, and when I was in Singapore, they actually called it the Central Business District. And I used that in 17.
Oh, gosh, that sounds very, very Orwellian.
And in 17, you can't just walk into the Central Business District. There's an electric fence around it. And you have to go through security like you go through an airport to get into the Central Business District because, you know, outside of it is a war zone. And everybody inside of it is trucked in under guard, and they work in their little buildings, and then they're trucked back out. So, yes, there is literally a gate in 17.
All right, and so you said this is going to be the first book in a trilogy, or is it going to be, do you envision many other books in the series?
I have one draft of another book done, but it's farther out. The whole series will trace humans as we replace the skills that we're used to thinking of as important with obedience. So right now, maybe to get ahead, you need to be smart. Maybe right now you need to be savvy to other kinds of business that are, you know, transactions that are being done, or you need to be able to read other people or something like that. In the future, as we become integrated into these big institutions, all of that stuff falls away, because what's really important is, did you do what you were told in a way that kept your boss happy? That is your number one survival skill.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. Now, did you see the I don't know if it's still in theaters, Elysium?
I have not.
You should probably check it out. It's not the same theme, but it's the idea of the Earth has become just a wasteland, and the privileged live in this artificial planet revolving Earth, and so everyone's just living in squalor. It's sort of like it's basically a Mexican ghetto, and they're trying to, Matt Damon's the protagonist, and he's trying to get up there because he's sick, and that's the sort of thing. You don't say yes to your boss. That's it. They'll find someone else. Like, go risk your life. You say, that's dangerous. I'm not going to do it. And okay, I'll find someone else in 2 seconds. And so people live in that constant sort of danger, and that's sort of, it's amazing to think that that's happening today too in our society. Maybe not to that extent, to that dangerous, deadly extent. But you know, some jobs, if you don't do what you're told, like you said, you're out. It's done.
Right.
You know, start all over again.
And the laws are being passed to prop up that system, you know, and to continue to make sure that it's not necessarily the most efficient business that's working anymore. It's the most, it's the one with the most power that can get regulations passed in its favor, if that makes sense. So, for example, it might be the way that you process your food that gets regulated. It won't necessarily be what's in it. So we used to regulate food and say, well, we're not going to let you put sawdust in the sausage. We're going to regulate it so that we see what's in the sausage, and you have to tell people what you put in the food before you sell it to them. Well, now that's not so true. They're pushing for things where you don't have to know what you're being fed anymore. But the regulation becomes, well, you have to have increasingly expensive equipment to process this food.
Right.
So mom and pop are getting squeezed out because
right.
they can't compete on the level that they're being regulated to, but yet we might still end up with sawdust in our sausage and we don't even know. But it's being produced on multi-million-dollar equipment.
Yeah, you know what? Since I was a kid, I didn't think that, you know, people were afraid of, you know, pollution and acid rain. For me, it's always been overpopulation. And that's when I saw that your book was about population reaching 17 billion. That for me is so frightening, this idea of just this overcrowding, overpopulation, that is what causes a lot of this violence. And gives these corporations and these governments the power to regulate because people are scared and they're going to take that, the sort of, what's the expression, the devil, you know, over the double.
Precisely. And like I said, with Asia, you know, Asia had high populations crammed into small places with few resources 1,000 years ago. And their societies became incredibly strict, top-down hierarchy. I had 1,000 students over a year in Korea. And I don't think I had one, because I asked in the class, I don't think I had one who chose his own or her own major in college. Every single person had their parents choose their major for them. And nobody thought that was weird.
Yeah, that's always frightened me, is that sort of overpopulation and people in such close proximity and having, and that's sort of where the disease and the violence comes from. And so I want to know, what are we in the States? 300 million? Are we over 300 million yet?
I think we're 309. I think the census said that we're 309 January 1st.
Jeez. All right. So
can you imagine? And with that, they said every 8 seconds, a new person is born, and every 12 seconds, a person dies.
Well, we've got what, two countries, India and China, that have over a billion? And probably Indonesia. Indonesia's a billion now, right?
Is it?
I think we have three countries now that are...
Hopefully that might be.
I know that China's like it's going to be like 1.5 billion, and India's... I don't know, it's just insane. I mean, granted, China's it's a huge landmass, and it's a pretty large place, and India is as well, but I can't imagine those images. I've never been to Asia, you've seen it in Singapore. I mean, just the crowd of people living on top of each other, literally. I mean, how many people are crammed into apartments? What are some of the things you saw just in Singapore? Did you see large families in these tiny shoeboxes?
Well, in Singapore, it's really interesting because most people live in government housing, and it's, you know, Asian societies in general are the most corporate societies, right. But there are different takes on that. You know, in Japan, everybody lived in company housing. In my book, 17, I based it on that part of life on Japan, and everybody who's inside the companies lives in corporate housing. Singapore, they had mostly government housing. I remember I was on a street where it had been redone. It was kind of a quaint little antique-y kind of district. All the buildings were really old-fashioned. And they said, oh, this used to be this terrible ghetto. And now, look, everybody's got a car. Everybody's got air conditioning. And I thought, wow, that's it. All over the world, these countries are developing. And they're getting all of these, you know, appliances. And the demand for, say, electricity to run all of these, for gasoline, for rubber, for tires, for whatever, is going up because as these countries develop, they start getting this need for all these consumer goods and all the power to run them and the clean water to drink and all of these things. So as we progress, as countries develop, as nations become industrialized, all of those same resources that we've been having at a lower price because there wasn't that international competition for, all of those goods are now going to go way up in price.
So yeah, that's what we're talking about, you know, corporations as governments or corporations taking over the government. You immediately made me think of Apple, which is now so rich and powerful. I think they're bigger. They're bigger than Microsoft. Yeah, we're speaking on Apple. I'm sure they've affected legislation in China, for example. Don't they have most of their factories in China? And
Mexico.
Yeah, with the nets around them.
Is that true? I was going to ask.
From jumping out.
Wait, what is that?
They apparently have suicide nets because the workers try to commit suicide. Well, they're making your iPhone. So, Stephen, are you your iPhone?
I'm not going to have the next iPhone. Thank you very much.
Well,
I'll go to an Android.
Well, that's why I have a Samsung, so that's South Korea. So
well,
that's
close enough.
But, I wonder if that's... But Apple is so rich and powerful. Now, that's a great example where their
influence...
I was reading this today, actually. The iPhone, the profits and power they generate from Apple is more than Microsoft combined, every Microsoft product combined.
Absolutely.
So they would have the power, if the Chinese government were to pass a law that was not favorable to Apple, Apple could say, all right, we're taking out our $50 billion a quarter worth of business and going to Indonesia or
Bangladesh. Under the entire country.
So that's where you could, absolutely sway the government. You don't think that the Chinese government would say, oh, they would bend over backwards to keep that.
Well, actually, it's interesting. You know, my wife's sister that I told you about, who was the arranged marriage, we have found out about her life over the past 2 decades, a little bit. And the guy she married, that was his business. They had sweatshops. And every time the labor rates would change and it would be a nickel more a day to pay these people to sew underwear and luggage, he would move the factory. So they went from South Korea to Indonesia to China, and I think they're in Vietnam now. And that's what they do. They shop around.
For the time being.
Right. And, you know, it'll be Pakistan or whatever. So.
Yeah. So where do they call home now?
Vietnam right now.
Vietnam. And have you been back to that part of the world to visit since you
I went in law school. I did a semester at the National University of Singapore in the law faculty.
What was your experience like as a law student rather than as a, you know, basically a fugitive when you were there? The previous time.
Studying with Singaporean law professors is just a trip and a half. And I raised my hand. I said, well, you know, you said that the people doing the hangings are experts at their job, and that the people doing the caning and leaving these permanent scars on people, you know, it's not just anybody off the street. They're professionals. They're experts at what they do. Is there an academy training
major?
Do they teach that from generation to generation?
apparently that it's on the job training. So.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Welcome to your first day of work here. Pull this lever.
Oh, what a great job! Do it again.
Well, how about those families, the groups in India that their job is that their caste is to burn people in the pyres?
Oh.
And that's actually, you're born into that. And it's actually, it's a very important service because all the dead bodies, they burn them in piles. There's a documentary on it.
Huh.
So I haven't gotten more than three minutes into it. I had to stop it.
You're like,
too much.
Yeah.
You don't have a marshmallow? Oh, wow. Oh, so that was what part of your law experience?
I did a semester over there, and I learned about, you know, the differences. I interned in a law firm there in the Central Business District.
It was a large firm, I'm sure.
This particular one was a what they call a boutique firm. It did high finance, banking, venture capital kind of stuff.
Okay.
And I met probably 20 or 30 venture capitalists in Singapore, which was really interesting because it was, 15 years ago or so. And
I was going to say, the late 90s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, focused on China.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, it's huge. Yeah, my friend who was there, I think that's what he was doing, was helping businesses set up in Singapore. I have to get the full story. I don't know why he came back to the States. Now he's living in L.A. teaching English. I don't know what...
It's like your reverse story.
It's completely, yeah.
We should have you both on.
We crossed paths.
But Mark, as far as, what influenced your novel and what was the most frightening aspect, you were in Singapore, you were in South Korea. Which one of those societies sort of scared you the most as being the closest to what's in your book as far as this sort of mix of corporate and government entity controlling everyone? Was it more Korea or Singapore?
I got little different parts of it from different places. So when I was in college, I had Japanese roommates. I never had an American roommate. I was part of the Japanese community. I spoke Japanese, dated Japanese girls, hung out with Japanese guys. My whole college experience was all Japanese people. And then I went to Japan, and I ended up homeless in Japan because one of the girls' parents thought I was a little too close to their daughter, and I didn't really have alternate place to stay. So I ended up staying in a park in Japan.
How are the accommodations?
Yeah, what were the accommodations like in the park?
You know, it's so weird. In Japan, everybody watches everybody, and there's never a moment when anybody's directly looking at you, but yet there's never a moment when you don't know you're being watched.
Well, it's funny, but the friend I was mentioning was in Singapore, just like you, who was in Japan for a long time. He said the worst thing, because I'd ask him about the dating and what are the girls like, and what, you know, he said, you know, the worst thing I've, and he's amazing at languages. He's a polyglot. I mean, he picks up languages. We were in France together, and he spoke fluent French. He spoke Russian.
I'm so envious of those kind of people.
And he said the worst thing I ever did for my life in Japan was becoming fluent in Japanese. He passed the exams at the high school level, so that's very fluent, for, even though he was late 20s or 30s, you know. And because they no longer saw him, they love to see Americans Westerners as novelties, and they were superior. And suddenly, here was this American, this dumb, stupid American who could learn their language. So yeah. he said it was absolutely they had this sort of look that they were before they used to, you know, invite him, be so hospitable. Suddenly, they were intimidated by him and almost revolted by him that he was able to speak their language and learn their culture. And I don't know if you experienced that. I found that very interesting. He said it was terrible for his dating life.
Yeah, well, I would say there's and this plays into some of what I put in 17 too. There is such a pressure to conform. And again, I chalk it up to it's an island country that gets hit with earthquakes, tsunamis, you know, they've got no arable land at all, you know, so they have to be incredibly conformist. I have pictures of traffic jams in Japan where I'm looking down a mountain toward the tunnel and we're, you know, it's all brake lights. And it was a very polite traffic jam, you know, they're in line and things. But every car in the line, in the picture that I took, is a white four-door sedan. Every car.
What is it?
And I would be on a bus, and there'd be an empty seat next to me, because it's so strange for, you know, me to be there that anybody sitting by me is, by extension, different. And the word in Japanese for different and the word for wrong are the same word as chigaimasu. So you would say that's wrong. That means that's different. It literally means that's different when you say somebody's wrong.
There's a term for outsiders, or even there's a few Japanese singers who are half American, half Japanese, and they call them like half cultures or something. There's a term for it. Like I can't remember her name. The Japanese singer, and I think one of her parents was American, but she's big in. What's her name? I don't know, I'll have to look it up, but and there was a term for these Japanese pop stars who had some Western blood in them or something crazy like that. You know, we wouldn't think to come up with a term like that, but it was important to identify them as not pure Japanese.
Right, well, they have an alphabet for that, too. They have a special alphabet for foreign words. You can spell phonetically in one Japanese alphabet, but if it's a foreign word, you have to use a different alphabet to show that it's not a Japanese word.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So, like, how do they spell apple?
It's all syllables, so it would be like apu-ru or something like that. But actually, they have a word for apple.
Yeah,
it
would be something like
or Nike or, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, bus, I know, is bus in the band.
Bus. Oh, right. The Mexicans call it guagua.
So what do you know? Do you obviously speak Korean, right? Do you speak Korean with your wife?
No. I tracked down an English professor at the National University in town and set up on behalf of myself and some of the other expatriate teachers there a special class to learn Korean. And my then-girlfriend, now wife, always found a way to keep me out of it. And at first I thought she was just...
You know, women have their ways.
I thought, oh, wow, she really wants to spend time. Well, it turns out, she didn't want me to learn the language because every time we walked down the street together, people would harass us and say nasty stuff to us. Mm-hmm. And she thought if I knew how to speak the language, that I would stab somebody and go to Korean jail, and then I couldn't get her out.
So she was actually trying.
She was a forward-thinking woman.
Right. She was trying to save your ass.
That's a great logic leap right there. I mean. Oh, yeah.
I don't want you to learn to keep going. You'll cut someone's head off and end up in jail. Oh, yeah.
So, Mark, do you have a temper?
Well, she thinks so. No, I did there, especially. I was really frazzled because it was a constant pressure. You know, it was
on.
It was like being a black and white couple in Mississippi in 1940, walking down the street.
I remember it well.
Jeez.
Yeah, I think I'm related to
Was that past life stream?
Yeah, well, I think I'm related to Shirley MacLaine when she was a lizard.
That would explain a lot of things. But before I forget, Mark, we've only got a few minutes left, and the outro music cuts off really quickly, so you might be in the middle of a sentence, and the music kicks in real quickly. So in the last few minutes, let me give out some of your information. So your website is armyofthedoom.com.
Yes.
Okay, with a little bit of a downer of a name, is there a sort of an irony to it? Or?
Well, the idea is that this hierarchy came from the military, you know, and once somebody learned that you can point up a hill and say, go kill everybody up that hill, and somebody says, yes, sir, and goes and does it, then that became the standard for the military. And anybody who didn't have that got wiped off the planet. And now that's happening in business. Now it's the small business looking at these giants, and the giant is saying, obey and wipe out these small businesses, and that's what's happening. So anybody who's an individual, anybody who's unique, and is basically being purged, and we're like the villagers standing before this modern mechanized army. So armyofthedoomed.com. And I'll tell you this, if you go to armyofthedoomed.com, you can find 17 on Amazon and all the links are there, but if you go to the Smashwords one, I've got a coupon code, and for a limited time, I think it's another week, that coupon gets you the book for free.
Oh, cool. Okay, great. Can we read it on Kindle and stuff too?
Yep, and Smashwords will download it. You just click the buy button as if you're going to buy it for $4 or whatever. Go to the last page for checkout, and it says coupon code. Put it in there, and it goes to zero.
Oh, that's awesome. I just got a Kindle for Christmas. I'm very excited. I love it.
Well, we'll post that, and we'll definitely post the information on the Continual Condition Facebook. And Mark, you definitely have to come on the show again because...
Yeah, an hour goes by so fast.
This has been great. Thank you so much for having me.
And you are... I see that you're in Cape Elizabeth, Maine. I don't know if you're familiar with Pemaquid. That's where my father's side of the family's from, and we've got a place near Damascata.
Oh, okay.
Near, I don't know if you know, Bristol and... So when I saw you were living in Maine, I'm like, oh, he was an attorney in Chicago, and now he's settled down into Maine. And I was wondering, is that sort of your solution to an escape from this corporate giant entity? How do we escape it? Do you talk about in your book of how we can free ourselves from this?
Well, you know, Maine's like going back in time. It's I don't know how long it'll last this way. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely a freer place. You can breathe here. You can, let your kids play in the street here.
We
eat with wood.
I agree. Listen, we have a place that my grandfather designed and built, and my dad, my sister own it now, and me too by default. But that's right in the ocean, and my dad said that it has not changed since he was a kid. He's in his late 60s. And there's still lobster boats going by. There's a couple bars in town. There's nothing. There's no. I mean, we have internet, of course, but it's like you said. There's no. Time is just sort of suspended. So that's the exact feeling I get there when I go. I only get to go a couple weeks a year now, but I would love to, retire there if I could. It just seems like you don't have all the constant pressure you have here in New York City, where it's for that race. It's like I'm sure you describe in your book but more to the 10th degree. But it's interesting. When I saw that you're living in Maine, I smiled. I said, I get it. That's if I were doing that in Chicago and just saying I don't agree with this, I'm just from Maine. People are going to leave me alone.
And I can write my books. I'm a Maine cliche. I'm from Maine to write my book.
So this is book one. When do you expect to have book two out?
Well, I'm taking a little sabbatical from the 17 series to get, as the book is getting out there and it's building some momentum on its own, and I'm going to write the story of us being chased out of South Korea and stranded in Hong Kong next. That'll be out in October.
Awesome.
And then the next one will come out, and hopefully another, you know, 6 months to a year after that.
All right. Well, listen, if you end up doing any book signings or promotions in the New York City area, let us know. We'll definitely...
Yeah, we'll let our fans know and our husbands and wives.
Yeah, and you can, like I said, definitely come on the show anytime, because this is a topic that, you know, when I was trying to get the show at UCY.TV, I said, these are the sort of topics I want to cover. I sort of want to, you know, stay away from politics as far as name-calling, but the idea of politics is fine. The idea. Mm-hmm. And so I like this because it's a theme that touches every society, and if it's not right now, it's going to in the future. And can we do something about it? I don't know, but the fact is we're having a dialogue about it. We're discussing it. And so I'm really, really happy you came on the show. And like I said, anytime you want to come on, just send me an email. We're going to share your link. So let me just share the website again. It's www.armyofthedoomed.com. That's all one word. And Mark's new book is called 17 Book One, which she was just telling us is going to be the first in a series. And you have a book before that too, right? You said it was sort of a Twilight parody, or was it a...
Yeah, it's not a parody because it's not funny. It's it looks like Twilight and it ends up more like Bright Lights, Big City.
Okay.
Oh, lovely. I'm gonna read that first
because I had a daughter reading Twilight when I was writing it. So it's like, no, here's what happens when you fall for the creepy guy.
Women love that. They love going for the creepy guy.
So, any parents out there whose daughter is into that kind of thing, yeah, get them Vita Nocturna by Mark D. Deal.
So wait, do you have kids?
Yes, I have one.
Okay, good. Well, Maine's a great place. Where is Cape Elizabeth, by the way? I'm trying to place it.
It's the little cape sticking off of Portland. It's basically
okay. So yeah, so you're about an hour and a half south of where my father's family's from, where our house is.
Okay.
So you probably heard of the Pemmican Peninsula area, but anyway, so let me repeat again. We'll wrap it up again. It's the armyofthedoomed.com, and our guest tonight has been Mark Deal, who's been an amazing guest. If you missed the beginning of the show, Mark is a novelist and former attorney who left that life to explore many avenues of fiction, and that's going to wrap up our show. Thank you so much, Mark, for being on the show.
Thank you, guys.
Have a great night.
Welcome back.